are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and I'm here in the studio today with two guests who have an event to talk about, and we have a lot to talk about with it. So welcoming back Larry Shook, who's been on the show once or twice through the years. He's an author and a journalist and a veteran who writes about, among other things, PTSD, issues facing veterans, moral costs of war, etc. And he'll talk about some of that today. And then Audrey Burr, who's here for the first time, who is a member of the steering committee at the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane and chair of the Peace and Justice Action Committee, who is putting on this panel on the 22nd. So thanks to both of you for being here. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure who makes more sense to tell us about the panel. But
Well, that might be me. I'll tell you a little bit about how we came up with this idea. The Peace and Justice Action League really believes that war is never a solution for a problem. And we've taken lots of actions and stands on that issue over the last 45 years. But of late, we decided that we needed to develop a long-term campaign that specifically looks at war and militarism and alternatives to those. So the committee has worked hard on a number of different events in the last couple of years, and we've always taken the stance that if the public only knew, they would make smarter decisions about how they vote, who they elect, how they handle themselves in terms of public policy. So we're keeping with that standard and decided that we would begin the long-term campaign with a panel that looked at the costs of war. The panel's called War No More, and we are going to be looking at the historical and cultural context of war. America really began with a militaristic stance against Native people, and we've continued that throughout our entire existence. Tom Janot, philosophy professor at Gonzaga, is going to start us off by grounding us in the history and cultural perspective. We are going to have a speaker, Todd Eckloff, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Spokane, talk about the moral cost of war. We'll have a speaker, George Taylor, from the Veterans for Peace, talk about the economic costs. And Larry Shook, who is here, is going to be talking about the human costs of war. We hope that by putting together this group of provocative speakers that will be able to challenge the assumptions of those in the audience about war and militarism and why we need to have alternatives that lead us to peace instead.
Cool. So it's going to be March 22nd.
Yes.
Right, at the Unitarian Church.
Yes. March 22nd, 6:30, Unitarian Universalist Church on Fort George Wright Boulevard.
Is there a cost to attend?
There's no cost to attend. There will be an audience panel discussion after the presentations, and we will end the evening with cookies and beverages. So there's got to be a reason for people to attend.
Something for everyone. Yeah. So, Larry, I guess that kind of leads. Well, Audrey said that, you know, PJLS has almost 45 year history of working on this work. You both have long histories of, we won't say exact years, long histories of working on issues of war and peace. And they're issues that really just haven't gone away. And I wonder from both of you, but maybe starting with Larry, your reflection on these last 20 years of kind of this, the war on terror era going on 20 years. And just why isn't ongoing war on the front of more of our minds? And
I think the answer to that question, Taylor, is the same today as it always has been, which is that it doesn't affect everybody. If it affected more people, people would be more engaged. In the height of the Vietnam War protest, there were a group of Hollywood celebrities who protested the war, and one of them was Paul Newman, and Paul Newman was really articulate, and he said, the public is tolerating this war because it doesn't affect the average person. And I don't think that's an accident. I want to follow up on something Audrey said a minute ago. The name of the conference is War No More, and no more is a double entendre, K-N-O-W, War No More. And Audrey said if the public knew more, they wouldn't tolerate it. That is generally accepted. Those who plan war, those who execute war, understand that you have to keep the wool pulled over the public's eyes. During the Vietnam War, the British journalist Alastair Cook did a BBC letter from America. And one of those letters was about the impact of bringing the war in Vietnam into the American living room. And he said, this is something we've never seen before. And the question is, can the public will to sustain the atrocity of war? And war is inherently an atrocity. It's atrocities are not just confined to the My Lais. The institution of war is an atrocity. Most of the people who suffer in war are not combatants. They're the people who get they're the innocent people who get caught in the crossfire and who then suffer generational trauma mm-hmm. from that. But the point of that particular report that Cook did was there's a real question about whether the ability to wage war can be sustained when you let reporters into the front lines and then let those pictures into the American living room. And Cook quoted a British general from World War I who was a censor. And he said, the news of the trenches, the front lines, has to be kept from the British public. He said, if the British public knew what was happening, we could not sustain the political will to continue this war for 1 week. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and you know, I mean, keep in mind, 2,500 years ago, Aeschylus said, the first casualty of war is the truth. We cannot wage war and tell the truth at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing that I'm concerned about these days, one reason is because I have it myself, is PTSD. And that's a classic example of an injury that results from ignorance.
Mm-hmm. And even if you look at the way that shifted, I think Vietnam was the first time that happened. And in some ways, it was the last time that happened, because the way that wars were covered mm-hmm. in my childhood and formative years through the war on terror stuff was much more abstract, much more filtered through the lens of an action movie, you know, all of those graphics mm-hmm. from the Gulf War and on. And even the way that journalists were embedded completely mm-hmm. changed too, you know.
Well, and the way we staff our military is different. We had a draft during the Vietnam War, and almost everyone was very close to someone who was drafted and who served in the war. Every day you heard the fatality statistics and for your local town as well. Whereas now we don't hear those things. And very few, relatively speaking, American families are touched by the military. So we can live our lives totally separate from any war that we are waging. And right now we're engaged in military activities in 69 different locations throughout the globe. And most Americans don't have a clue about what that is. And we can stay happily ignorant. And that allows us to not think about it until it's budget time. President Trump just proposed his budget, which includes an increase in defense spending and dramatic cuts in all of the social safety nets. Those cuts are going to affect more people. So the truth of that will come out if it's allowed to and if it's encouraged on through the media.
Mm-hmm. And so I found this story that I'm sure you're both probably familiar with, the Costs of War Project. I know that Pajals uses it, some of the materials. Mm-hmm. That's at the Watson Institute at Brown University. But there was a really good story in The Nation by Stephanie Savelle, who works on the Costs of War Project. And she talks about exactly what you just said, that detachment, they basically track that the detachment has grown, you know, contrasting like Vietnam and War on Terror. But that it's also... it's about the what she says is the demobilization of the American people. And it's partially that the government demands nothing of the public, not even minimalist acts like buying war bonds, as in World War II, which would not only help offset the country's growing debt from its war making, but might also generate actual concern and interest in those wars. Because, you know, these have been funded by loans, by debt. The U.S. has been basically putting the wars on the credit card instead of taxation increases or other things like that. So,
yeah, which is why most years during tax season, the Peace and Justice Action League does an informational political action event relating to where your tax dollars go in regards to military spending and where you might like them to go. If we bought a few less bombers, we might actually be funding rebuilding some of the bridges that are about to fall down, even in Spokane. So we try to connect those dots about the choices that are made and help people really understand and feel the impact. But it's a tough sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, I don't know, what are you most excited to have shared during the panel that you think, just for you, I mean, you don't have to choose a favorite panelist or anything like that, but what do you think, I don't know, what made you start caring about this issue?
Well, you don't want to go back 50 years. So
we can
to hear that. But it's been a lifelong passion for me to work on anti-war issues. But for this panel, I really wanted to have speakers that would kind of smack the audience on the side of the head and get them to look at things differently. And even our speaker, George Taylor from Veterans for Peace, who's talking about the economic costs, you know, there's some standard figures, but he's got some statistics that just kind of knock your socks off. And I'm looking for each of the speakers to say something so provocative that the audience actually groans when they stop to think about it. The human cost, as Larry talks about it, we think of those who are killed in war, and we think of those who are injured, and we think of poor civilians, and, you know, it's kind of a big number, it's a big picture, we don't really want to think too much about it. But when he talks personally about the trauma of war and how every single person in the military is exposed to that trauma, that's going to be very profound. And when Todd Egloff talks about our willingness to send young people with only partially developed cognitive and emotional skills, when we are willing to sacrifice those young people for a war, that's going to make, I hope, the audience pause about that. Mm-hmm. And think, you know, what are we doing here? Why are we so attached to war?
Yeah.
Let me take a stab at a provocative statement. I suggest that every American watch the documentary film, Thank You for Your Service. In that documentary, you will hear senior military officials and senior government officials explain that they have been ordered to keep silent about the psychological damage that it does training people for war. In that film, you will hear Brigadier General Laurie Sutton, who's a psychiatrist. You will hear Navy Commander Mark Russell, who's a PhD psychologist, say that when we invaded Iraq, they knew what the psychological impact was going to be on our troops, and they were told to keep their mouths shut about it. They were ordered to be quiet about it. And by way of a personal anecdote, when we invaded Iraq, I have PTSD, and I'm always surprised by the things that can trigger a response. Mm-hmm. And when we invaded Iraq, of course, I was appalled. There are no words to describe my reaction. I was walking down the street, and a dear friend of mine had a big American flag on the side of his wall, an expression of patriotism. And it was all I could do to fight the impulse to walk across the street and rip the flag down and knock on his door and throw it in his face. And the reason was because I realized that we were about to send our young soldiers into urban combat. In urban combat, you will hurt civilians. There is no way to avoid it. Part of my trauma from Vietnam is that we fought battles in villages, in simple, humble, subsistence culture villages, and we destroyed those villages. And I am haunted to this day by what I was a part of. And I knew that that's what we were going to be sending our young people into. If you ever hurt a civilian, you will never have another day in your life, ever, for the rest of your life, when you don't remember that and when you don't carry the grief of it. So these senior officials, and it included Defense Secretary Robert Gates, they knew that we did not have adequate behavioral health care in place to address this wound. What we now call PTSD, psychotrauma, is the most common wound of war. It's way more common than Purple Heart wounds. It's the most common wound of war. Why? Because a healthy human being doesn't want to hurt other people. And what the U.S. Army learned after World War II is that 80 to 85% of our soldiers would not fire their weapons at the enemy in battle to save their lives or to save the life of a friend. That comes from the official combat history of World War II by Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall. Read Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's book on killing. And Colonel Grossman was a 23-year veteran Army Ranger, which is an elite soldier. And he became a clinical psychologist after his military career. And he taught psychology at West Point. And what Lieutenant Colonel Grossman points out is that in Vietnam, 95% of us fired our weapons at the enemy. I'm one of them. What happened? What happened between World War II and Vietnam? And as Grossman says, we use brainwashing against our troops. So if you want a normal person to... The appropriate way to think about military training is this. It trains us to engage in the ultimate antisocial behavior, killing and destroying. You cannot take a healthy human being, that's what the Army learned, that's been raised in a reasonably functional family, that's had a reasonably effective education, that's installed the social contract. You can't say, here, go kill these people who you don't even know, because I tell you to do it. We won't do it. If you want us to kill, you have to brainwash us. That creates a lifelong injury. And that is what is being swept under the table now, and it's intentional. It's not accidental.
Well, and that's why you say that even just the training can have these effects, even if you don't see combat to a lesser extent, even just going through the training process.
Military training is PTSD, Taylor. We know that. I mean, the statistic that I just cited is one example of it, but here's another. In the classic World War I book, All Quiet on the Western Front, the author points out that when World War I got fully involved and Germany was just rushing troops to the front line, inadequately trained troops had casualty rates of 500% to 1,000% higher. You have to change the brain to send people into war, or you are truly sending lambs to the slaughter. But if you leave that brain in place, my brain is forever changed. Mm-hmm. If you leave that brain in place and then say, thank you for your service, and now go be a good citizen, you're asking for the impossible. You set in motion a witch's brew of mental health disorder.
And recruitment for the military targets young men and women, but predominantly men, who are in lower-income areas, who are often people of color, targets them and sells them the idea that joining the military will give them a ticket for the future. They will be trained. They will be treated well. They will have educational benefits after their years of service. These are young people whose cognitive development is not complete until they're in their early 20s. They're often 18, 19 years old, and they're buying the recruitment pitch. And then once they get in, those unformed brains that don't have enough critical thinking skills or enough emotional development to question what's being taught them, they really buy into the model of we are doing the good fight. This is what we have to do because the enemy is so evil. So, you know, as Larry's taught me, even if they do not see combat, even if they are sitting here comfortably in the United States sending out drones, they are as traumatized as if they were in that city shooting all those people. But they bought into the model that this is the good fight. And the public buys into the model that we must wage this good war because those terrorists or whoever are going to take over our way of life.
Mm-hmm. So it's a double, I mean, you mentioned the disproportionate impact on people of color in recruiting, yes. But then obviously also the way that, particularly with the war on terror, but with other wars too, there's a second layer of bigotry that gets added because you mm-hmm. have to dehumanize the enemy, quote unquote.
So right, it's this... right. And frequently the enemy is a people of different religion and a different racial or ethnic background. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty easy to set them aside, separate them, and demonize them mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Larry Shook and Audrey Burr about an upcoming panel discussion called War No More, KNOW. And it is going to be Friday, March 22nd, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Spokane. You can find more at peacejustice.org, which is the PJOWLS, the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane website. Try to avoid acronyms. There's so many in the world. We're just talking about war. Why don't we talk about it more? What do we not know? How do we even find out what we don't know, etc.? So Larry's one of the panelists, and there's three other panelists, and it should be a good night. So we're just getting everyone ready for it right now.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. You brought up, you both brought up an interesting point around, like, why do people support war in general? And you talked about the good fight and this internalization of the idea of the good fight, which really seems, at least at a leadership level in this country, to be baked in across the parties. I think a couple months ago, it might have been longer ago, there was a point at which Donald Trump made a surprisingly stark comment, and he said, "We've put $7 trillion into the war on terror," which is a slightly inflated number. He said $7 trillion, and all that's got us is death and destruction. And because it was Trump saying it, all of these people rushed to say, well, it's not $7 trillion, it's $4 trillion at most. So he's just being ridiculous. And I thought it was a really interesting moment because people chose, rather than to focus on the fact that it is kind of a big deal for the commander in chief to say we've done all this and got nothing out of it, even if the person in question is a buffoon or whatever. That was a big deal. But people left, right, center rushed to mm-hmm. say, well, it's not $7 trillion. And that was an outrageous thing to say, you know. So it just seems kind of baked in
right.
across
and
the board.
They didn't address the death and destruction part of his statement, which was stunningly great to hear from him. I don't know if he knew what he was saying, but but no one commented on that. And we have spent, you know, $4 trillion, $7 trillion. It's just a gob of money, and it has not made the world a better place. But it is sacrilegious, almost, certainly unpatriotic, to question why are we doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I love the patriotic question. I love for people to call my patriotism into question. My understanding of the American ethic is that each of us as a citizen owes a duty to answer the question, what is patriotic? It's not to accept somebody else's definition of patriotic. I'm a lifelong journalist, and it's interesting to me that in the last few months, two very high-profile journalists have left the mainstream media because of its compliant ignorance of the way this country is so ruthlessly using war. Former NBC correspondent William Arkin is written, now refers to America as a war party. We're not a Democratic Party and a Republican Party anymore. We are a war party. And when he wrote his letter of resignation to NBC, which went viral, subsequently he was interviewed on CNN, and I think the interview was January 6th, and he said to his interviewer, America right now is bombing, I forget the number, 9 countries or 12 countries. And he said, can you name those countries? And the correspondent couldn't. And Arkin said, no, of course you can't, because the media is not covering it. You can go on to YouTube and you can look at a TED Talk given by Mike Haney, who's a retired Air Force major. And he points out that he did this TED Talk in 2014, and he pointed out that in the 40 years before America did away with the draft in 1973, this country had used military force 24 times. In the 40 years since then, 134 times. It is a wanton, irresponsible use of violence. Mm-hmm. And when we engage in violence, our wars today have nothing to do with freedom. They have nothing to do with protecting the virtues of our way of life. They're resource wars. They're wars about profit. And what the public needs to understand is that it is only the public that can change this. The policymakers cannot change it because they're beholden to these enormous economic interests. And as James Ryson, former New York Times writer, points out in his book, Pay Any Price, the national security state is the military-industrial state on steroids, because now we have this profound terror to appeal to. And this nation is engaging in the indiscriminate use of violence, in my opinion, as irresponsibly as any country in history has.
Yeah. And, when you say that the public and that the interviewer on CNN was unaware of all the places, I would make an assumption that I would be surprised if it weren't true, in at least some cases, that a lot of the policymakers themselves probably can't rattle off every country that we're involved in, way or another.
69 of those places. And when a soldier was murdered in Africa a year or two ago, everyone was shocked because no one knew what our troops were doing in that remote African country. I can't even remember the name of it. We don't know what's going on. And part of that is it's very difficult to find out that information. You run into the classified standard. So even lawmakers can't call up their buddy at the Department of Defense and say, okay, so give me a rundown on all the places. So it's purposely kept secret because common folks can't understand the threat of terror. Mm-hmm. Even though there are more deaths caused by domestic terrorism than there are by terrorism on other soils against Americans, we still are reluctant to call that terrorism because we want it to be over there, those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't want to see that comes back to the cultural, psychological,
Right.
Argue that the profile of virtually all, with almost zero exception, of domestic terrorists has been white men, mm-hmm, disaffected in some way, who are the prime targets of militarism also.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, there is a really good map that I will share on the podcast that's also from Costs of War that shows just the locations in what they refer to as all, like, the counter-terror war, quote-unquote war on terror, whatever we're calling it right now, if we are even talking about it. And it's color-coded by, they say, 76 total affected countries through the combination of air and drone strikes, combat troops, U.S. military bases, and then training other governments in counterterrorism. So kind of spreading the model that we have through 58 other countries, 58 locations where that training's happening. So, yeah. And a lot of times we don't hear about it until a couple of years on. Mm-hmm. So, which is exactly what you were saying. So,
yeah. And because a militaristic approach is so embedded in our culture and really in our way of life in America, we're relatively comfortable with our Department of Defense and our military branches conducting those actions. A lot of people would say we don't need to question that. We also don't question the increasing militarization of law enforcement here in our country. And you can see that anytime there's any reporting on local TV about an arrest, when the police show up in an armored vehicle and fully armed and fully covered with armor, you know, that's militarization. That's mm-hmm. not person-to-person policing. That's a militaristic action. And we're comfortable with that in this country. And mm-hmm. that's something that we want to shake up a little bit, and we'll be doing that in future mm-hmm. Events as part of this campaign, because we need to stop and think about that. Mm-hmm. When you look at TV shows and movies, there's a glorification of police shows that involve a lot of this militaristic action, and a glorification of soldiers going overseas and doing little drop-in military actions, and there's no context for it. So it's just kind of a drop-in, drop-out, no harm, no foul. Let's go on to the next one.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad that you mentioned the militarization of the police at home, and kind of the ripple effect, the boomerang effect mm-hmm. that it has. I'd love to hear mm-hmm. a panel. I'd love to hear from our Progressive City Council about their approval of both drones and a new Bearcat. They don't want to borrow the sheriff's Bearcat anymore, which is one of those armored vehicles.
Yeah, and we need to talk about our attachment to guns, military-style weapons. And you know, the controversy over the latest gun law change is astonishing, until you realize that we love war, and we love the military, and we love having all that arsenal at our disposal in the back room.
We love war as long as it's Denzel Washington portraying the romanticism of war. We don't love war when it comes to facing the reality of what it does to our young people who we send to war. Again, if you look at that documentary, Thank You for Your Service, you will see Commander Russell describe how he was one mental health care professional on a Marine base in Japan serving 6,000 Marines. And these young folks would get off the plane from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were an absolute mental basket case. And it was an exercise in absurdity for him to try to attend to their mental health emergency. He sent memo after memo up the line to his superiors asking for action to correct the situation. They were all ignored. For some reason, he was invited to speak at a big military medical conference in the summer of 2006. You can see all this on the documentary. And he said, here's the truth about what's going on. The military newspaper Stars and Stripes picked up that story and ran the story in September of 2006. Then USA Today picked it up and ran it in January of 2007. Then Commander Russell got instruction from his commanding officer to not talk to the media anymore. Then the Navy issued an official response, and they denied the truth about what was happening. That part of that documentary is actually a criminal indictment. The Navy was lying about what was happening to our military personnel. This nation does not love the truth of war. One-tenth, we're the most powerful military nation in history. One-tenth of 1% of our citizens have gone to war, have served in combat. We're profoundly, in fact, in his book on killing, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman points out that we are as illiterate about violence as the ancient Celts were about sex. They did not know, they did not know that babies came from sex. He says we are literally that ignorant about violence.
Well, and there was a strong campaign during the Gulf Wars to not diagnose military personnel with PTSD. They could be diagnosed with some other conditions, but if they were going to seek some kind of long-term treatment or disability payment for that diagnosis, they would not be given it. At the same time, they were also reluctant to assign a traumatic brain injury diagnosis, which is extremely common because of the nature of war, and they were starting to decide that maybe they were the same thing, not true, but they were reluctant to give those diagnoses because they require long-term treatment and are likely to lead to long-term disability.
Mm-hmm. 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 Which is long-term cost, I suppose, added to the cost that has already been expended up front. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Larry Shook. He's a veteran, an author, journalist, and a panelist on this upcoming event, War No More. That's going to be Friday, March 22nd from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. At the Unitarian Church. And Audrey Burr, who is organizing that panel with the Peace and Justice Action Committee at the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane. So I want to shift gears a little bit because we talked at the very beginning. This whole idea is education coming before mobilization, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in terms of in a military sense, so many of our words are even threaded with militarism, but education before we can take action and change this culture. I guess for both of you, what is your hope for, you say, you know, if the public knows, then what? Like, what do you think our best bet is in terms of addressing this culture that runs so deep, and that has so much power and, attached to it.
Well, and we might have slightly different approaches there because you have a very specific long-term hope. My hope is that the audience at this panel will leave saying, I had no idea, and will need to go home and talk with someone to share what they knew. And that person will also say, I had no idea. So that when they're reading the news, when they're hearing about these things, they'll stop and wonder if that's really true. But also so that we can mobilize more people to speak up about what the American people really do want, because that's a standard phrase. The American people want us to wage war on terror. Well, the American people haven't been asked. So we want the American people to stand up and speak about what they want in terms of military spending and engagement in these practices. So it's a long-term campaign because it's difficult to get people to stand up. But we have unfortunately, lots of opportunities to speak out. There is regular talk of military options in Venezuela, mm-hmm. A country that we really have no business going mm-hmm. to visit on mm-hmm. a military basis. And should action be taken, we hope that this kind of awareness will increase the numbers of people who speak out against that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a journalist, and I'm a great believer in the public's right to know, and I'm a great believer in the wisdom of crowds, that, you know, we are collectively wiser than we can be individually. And so my great hope is to be able to educate the public. I've been a journalist for about 50 years, and unlike a lot of journalists, I'm not a cynic. My career in journalism has taught me to have great respect for the public and great hope for the public. I really trust the goodness of the human heart. And my hope is to find a way to communicate with the public so that it can to engage its heart so that its heart can really understand. You know, this nation came into existence in a frenzy of great idealism, and we immediately institutionalized slavery, which was a direct contradiction to the values that we articulated in the Bill of Rights and so forth. And it took, over 50 years to confront the institution of slavery. And there's a famous anecdote in which Abraham Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe. And he said, "So you're the little lady who started the Civil War." It's like America engaged in this political debate, this intellectual debate about, well, is slavery okay? But when the public's heart was touched, the image that I have is that this nation put its hands to its chest and ripped its heart out on the battlefields of the Civil War. We just said we can't endure that. We can't accept that. And I happen to believe humanity is at a crossroads mm-hmm. now with regard to our consciousness. I'm very hopeful that when we understand the reality of violence, we will find alternatives to engaging in violence to resolve our differences. From my point of view, as a veteran of war, what I say about war is that it makes as much sense in achieving national objectives or resolving differences as fighting fires with gasoline. It is the most counterproductive thing that can be done, measured any way you want to measure it.
Larry, you also are interested in some national legislation related to the trauma of war. And that might be, I would think that getting some interest in getting that legislation attended to and talked about in Congress would also be one of your hopes.
Yeah, so I'm advocating what I call the Military Behavioral Healthcare Reform Act. And it would require two things. Number one, rigorous education about the reality of traumatic injury as an integral part of military training and military service. So you know from the beginning that your brain is being changed. Mm-hmm. We cannot send you into war without changing your brain. And then number two, so and if you don't understand what's happened to you, it just intensifies your isolation. It intensifies your anxiety. You feel ashamed. You feel stupid. It's just awful. All clinicians who study traumatic injury say education is the foundation. You need to understand what it is you're dealing with. And then number two, provision of lifelong complex rehabilitation to men from the injury. That term comes from Dr. Charles David Tauber, who's one of the world's foremost authorities on psychosocial trauma. He studied the trauma of the Balkans since the Balkan War. And he points out that what happens when humanity goes to war is that we blow the heck of the physical infrastructure. Now there's rubble everywhere. You can't flush the toilets. The lights don't come on and so forth. And so we go in and we rebuild the physical infrastructure, but we leave the psychological infrastructure in ruins because we don't understand what we've done. And that just perpetuates the cycle, this endless cycle of violence. The solution, he says, is complex rehabilitation. And that exists nowhere in the world today. And so that's my passion, to educate the public about the need for that. If you train people to be effective soldiers, and I do not advocate, I'm not an advocate of unilateral disarmament. And what I would say to anybody who advocates unilateral disarmament is, if you think you know a way to precipitately change human nature in such a way as to eliminate the need for armed defense, try it at the community level first. Just have your police department stand down for 24 hours. If you think you can eliminate the need for armed law enforcement, give it a shot. That's not talking about needless wars. It's not talking about brutal police activity. It's talking about legitimate protection of public safety. But you're smiling.
We should come back for a whole hour on that someday. Because I see what you're saying there.
And the point is, if you train somebody adequately to engage in military work, and then you send them to military work, as I did, I have a year of combat, and then you think you can rehabilitate that brain with an hour a week with a shrink. Mm-hmm. That's extremely naive. Mm-hmm. And if you think you can do it with pharmaceuticals, that's beyond naive. Mm-hmm. That's cynical. The VA has a cohort study of 1 million people. A million person cohort study is a huge cohort study.
That's unheard of. Yeah.
It's unheard of. They have 1 million cohort study of veterans that they've used antidepressants on. It doubled the incident of suicide, not suicidality, not suicide ideation, but suicide. Mm-hmm. And yet that is still the VA's approach mm-hmm. to this rehabilitation is an hour, a week or so of cognitive therapy. Well, think differently about your experience mm-hmm. or these pharmaceuticals that have proven to be deadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you say complex, too, I think part of my understanding of what more complex therapy looks like would be engaging families, engaging communities in that education too. So you're not still isolated. You're not going from the isolation of your own mind to the isolation of being alone with a shrink to the, to the isolation within your family of thinking that you're going to take these pills and get quote unquote better,
Well, and the family is the secondarily traumatized by having this soldier go away and come back. Not themselves and reactive and really traumatized. They also experience trauma and they need treatment as well. And in many ways, you could almost extend it to the community. It needs to be part of this process because when we have military parades, when we have 4th of July fireworks, when we have all these movies and TV shows that involve a lot of shooting them up and drone strikes and video games that involve all that, that re-traumatizes these folks. And so we need to have the public needs to participate in the complex treatment.
And what the studies show now, Audrey, is that for a long time we thought that the spouses and families of traumatized soldiers experienced what we called secondary mm-hmm. trauma. Now what's being recorded is primary mm-hmm. trauma. Mm-hmm. That workshop that I did at PJAL's a couple of weeks ago was with the widow of my former platoon leader mm-hmm. in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. She and her daughter have primary PTSD mm-hmm. as a result of living for 35 years with his PTSD. I also want to follow up on what you said a minute ago, Taylor. That's really astute, including the community. Mm-hmm. What happens when you have PTSD is that you are isolated. And when you are relationship is the key to healing. What that does is it releases endogenous opioids. The reason there's an opioid crisis is because we have opioid receptors in the body. They make us feel better, right? Well, natural opioids, which the body produces, endorphins, et cetera, are way more effective than synthetic opioids can ever be, and that the simple solution of connection is a source of endogenous opioids.
And that goes way beyond shaking a veteran's hand, saying thank you for your service. That's a trite talking down to and minimization of what the service involved. And so I think it means being able to talk to returning soldiers and not avoiding them and not isolating them and really welcoming them back into the community without glorifying mm-hmm. their service, welcoming them back to take part in natural life as a community member.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say one of my strongest held views is that as long as this country or any country goes to war, 100% of our citizens should go to war. There should be a draft. Nobody should be able to avoid the experience of war. I don't mean that everybody's on the front line as a combat person, mm-hmm. but bone spurs won't keep you out of it.
AKA yeah. being really rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really hope that they change selective service to include women soon, because I think that would be a touchstone to force the conversation. Because still, even though women can fully join all the branches at this point, we're not required to register for selective service at 18. And I think when they make that change, mm-hmm. I hope. That's the only thing I can see on the immediate horizon that might force that conversation a little bit. If people have to say, my fragile daughter can't do that. We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to bring up the only times, something that's given me a lot of hope regarding militarism in the recent past is some of these freshman folks in the House and kind of just this wave in the House proposing some policy, which has not been the norm for many years, regarding addressing climate change in a serious way, looking toward universal health care, people being much less afraid to say the phrase universal health care. There's always this question of how are we going to pay for that? And I think that that's a window where we can say no one ever asks how are we going to pay for that when we expand drone strikes to Yemen and mm-hmm. Somalia, you know, and when we mm-hmm. arm the Saudi yeah. government, et cetera. So what do you think that I'm right to be hopeful about that, or naive to be hopeful about that?
Well, you know, I think people are more activated and paying a little bit more attention generally. And the new budget that's proposed by the president mm-hmm. includes expanding and creating a new branch, not full branch, but branch of the Air Force, the Space Force. And if as if we need to militarize outer space, the stars and the moon and the heavens. But I think people step back and say, whoa, do we need to do that? And what if we instead, because I think people are very aware that healthcare has, we are in a crisis, a true emergency in regards to access to health care and the provision of health care, the cost of health care. It's just a blooming mess, and it needs a great deal of money. But you have to make a choice. You know, are you going to militarize outer space, or are you going to address these needs that many, many people feel? Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that people will step up about that.
I'm with you, Taylor. It seems to me that we may have a historically good crop of elected officials right now. I'm really encouraged by a lot of what I see happening. I was really encouraged by Senator Martha McSally's press conference last week. This is the first woman combat pilot, and she announces not only was she raped by a superior officer, she was raped by the institution. And I was really encouraged by that public exposure and discussion.
Mm-hmm. And that she brought it up for the first time on the floor. That was powerful.
In the panel discussion, there was a gentleman who's left. How much time do we have, Tyler?
A minute. You're good.
There was a gentleman sitting in the panel who was a former Air Force prosecuting attorney. He was one of the, Colonel Christensen. He became one of the Air Force's major rape busters. And you can read a New York Times story called The Military's Rough Justice on Sexual Assault. And it points out that the reason that Colonel McSally couldn't get any justice is because there's a loophole in military justice that allows commanding officers to overturn a guilty rape conviction. I imagine Senator McSally is going to have some more to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, rape is a tool of war. It's another instrument of war. And when the military is so fired up on violence, rape is violence. And so it's no surprise to me that it's becoming more and more common amongst the military. Mm-hmm. And it's another thing that has to be addressed.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you both. Do you want to give the details for the event that we've been talking about one last time?
The Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane invites you to a panel discussion, War No More, Our Militarism Costs the United States. It will be held Friday, March 22nd from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Spokane. And that is at 4340 West Fort George Wright Boulevard. We invite you to come.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for being on the show with me today.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thanks.
Yeah. See you soon. All right, and thank you all for listening. If you missed any part of the show and you want to catch it, you can find the podcast either by going to kyrs.org, going to Programs, and clicking on Praxis, or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio, and find it there and subscribe. You can also look it up on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can email me with questions, show tips, and the rest at Praxis, PraxisRadio, at kyrs.org. I'll be back next week.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.